All right, got boys and girls, we're on lesson 11, which is the second part of the resurrection on trial. This is part two from the case for Christ, and we're going to do a little review. And Blake is joining us. I think he joined us like the last class before this. We had this pandemic, and so this is I think his first time back since then. So, anybody, Blake, anybody, you just stop me at any time so this doesn't seem like a lecture for this thing. One thing I wanted to throw out there before we get started is for the last class, we're going to try to do a review, and Park and I are trying to think of different things to do, try to maybe do quickly. Every lesson we were on there, but one of the things we had mentioned earlier is that if you had any questions, like questions of your own or questions that other people have posed to you or some skeptics or something, maybe to give those to us and we'll present it to the class and we'll see if we can munch and crunch on it with some of the things that we've, our own knowledge we've developed over the years and maybe something from the class and see if we can work through some of those things. So, just try to figure out what's something to do for the last class, which is basically a giant review. So this review, we said that there was like five possibilities, theories about Jesus' resurrection. And what people have said is either Christianity is a hallucination, is a myth, or is a conspiracy, or is the swoon theory. And of course, we looked at some of these or refuted some of these. And so we really have to look at the one. I think the second one, it says Jesus didn't rise. The apostles were deceived, or that he did rise and the apostles made it all up. And just myth makers, and Jesus didn't rise and the apostles, they were deceivers. They were deceived the whole world. Or that Jesus didn't die. And we spent a lot of time Sunday looking at the swoon theory that seems to be very popular, that Jesus basically survived all the things that happened to him on that dreaded day. And so the swoon theory, or hypotenuse for those that were not here, says that the idea that Jesus never died on the cross, that instead of resurrection, he was resuscitation. Some say because of the cool, damp air of the tomb, and some of the things they point out, possibly this theory is like when he took when he said, "I thirst," and they put a liquid up to his mouth, they said it may have been something to knock him out, may make him appear like he was dead. But again, it's like a bunch of urban myth things, and so, Lee Strobel is like, can somebody actually survive what a typical person goes through under Roman rule with the scourging and the crucifixion? Can he some kind of way survive that and then appear as if everything's okay? And so we looked at basically the ordeal that Jesus went through. So we looked at what we call flogging or scourging we see in a lot of Bibles. And we talked about how terribly brutal it was. This historian said that the sufferer's veins would be laid bare. The very muscles, sinew, and the bowels of the victim were open to
Hey.
Locked up? Yeah.
Oh, okay. We're all just kind of chilling here.
Okay.
Did you? Okay, I don't know what that was, but he said the computer locked up on him. That's odd. I wish I had some slides. There we go.
All right. Unmute myself. Goodness gracious. Oh, did it disappear? Are you guys still there? No.
We're here.
All right. Why don't I see my Zoom? Okay. Let's see. Share.
Yeah.
Oh, my word. See, Loretta always has this problem. And now it's me. It's finally caught up to me.
Hmm.
I don't know what happened. I don't know.
Yeah.
All right, so let me get – what was the last thing you guys heard before I just died off?
You were on that slide with the crucifix. Yeah, that thing right there.
Okay. All right. I'm not sure how much you heard, but I was talking about the scourging again and what happens to a person. I think I said hypovolemic shock, and then I think everything went crazy. But during the beating, this was what someone would they said, if you're going through this shock, the four things that somebody would go through, their heart tries to pump the blood that isn't there. Second, the blood pressure would drop, causing fainting or collapsing. And third, the kidneys stop producing urine to maintain the volume is left. And fourth, the person become very thirsty as the body craved fluids to replace the blood lost. And we said that Jesus experienced at least two of those things. He was unable to carry that cross. So and he did say that he thirsted on the cross. So we said he was experiencing this thing from the bloody beating, from the scourging or the flogging. Talked about him being nailed to the cross and what's about that. What goes into that about the Romans would use a spike about 7 inches long, and they would actually penetrate the wrist and the ankle bone, not the actual palms. Because the weight of the body could not be sustained if they actually, I know a lot of pictures depict that, but even in the scriptures, it does say his hands and feet, but the language of the day, that's the way they described it. So it's not a contradiction, but this is what they were doing in those different slides you see there. That one to the bottom left was they found a boy that had been crucified, and that's kind of the bone and the actual one of the spikes there. And so they did they recreated that to show that that's how they actually would nail someone to the cross. And in doing so, those spikes would hit a nerve. And one of the things we talked about, and I don't know how many here, I think everybody's here, but except for Blake, I think is on this call. But the word excruciating was actually developed or created because of the pain that the cross created. Before then, they had to give you an idea. This thing was so bad, the pain of it was so bad that they created a word to describe it. And they said, you know, if you ever hit your funny bone, you know how terrible that feels. They said this is another nerve. And these nails were hit right in the wrist, and the ankle would go right in those. And so the person is just going through just awful pain right now when they are nailing him to the cross. And so Jesus actually died by asphyxiation. So as you can see, pictured here with your arms stretched out, you would most likely your shoulders would get dislocated, and we pointed out that one of the Psalms actually foretold the crucifixion hundreds of years beforehand, said that my bones are out of joint. But if you can imagine being suspended by your wrist and your feet, you know, that's pretty torturous that's going on. And they said three things that would happen now to a person that's on that cross, that now he's being fully supported by his feet, the nails that are there, the pain that's going through his legs, the pain that's going through his wrist. And now the motion, the torturous part is how you have to breathe. The initial with your arms stretched out in the down position, it's in an exhale position. So if you want a breath, you actually have to push up on those nails that's in your ankle, push up and raise your diaphragm open so you can take a breath. And then you sag back down. And so you had to do this in order to breathe. And, of course, you're rubbing your back that has just been brutalized by the – I think it was like the Romans said it was 39 lashes. I don't know if they even kept count. But, again, they said some people didn't even survive the scourging. So you would have to do this until your arms and you were just too tired or too painful to do anymore, and you would basically suffocate. Let's see, next slide. Uh-oh, don't freeze up on me now. I'm hitting my buttons, but nothing's going anywhere. I wouldn't be surprised if I end up all the way at the end of the lesson. Okay, here we go. Oh boy. I mentioned that with all that pain that was going on that Jesus experienced, that he didn't say, you know, the scriptures talks about how quiet he was and the things he did utter. That you see one through the seven things he did. Only one thing was about himself, and that's number five when he said, "I thirst." Everything was in regard to someone else, thinking about someone else. And they were just saying, it's just amazing what Jesus was able to do and what normal people would not be able to do. And then, of course, I put up 1 Peter 2:21-25. That talks about how he didn't return insults or threats or anything else. What we showed Sunday is actually after the scourging, how they mocked him and the things they did to him, and he never responded in kind. And of course, 1 Peter said this is the pattern that he left for us. And one of the things I mentioned, just the craziness that's going on today, that Jesus would actually still do that, knowing that we would do a lot of ugly things. And that's the amazing thing that continues to be the most amazing thing, that because if we knew how people were either going to treat us or not respect something that we've either sacrificed for them, a lot of times we either wouldn't do it, be very hesitant to do it, anything else. But Jesus knew, each one of us, the things that we were going to do, and yet he was still willing to go through this on our behalf. And these, again, two medical words I can't pronounce, but what does paracardia and perifusius, whatever. I did better Sunday. I think I'm all flustered because of this computer. But anyway, as a result of the shock, the hypervolemic shock and the rapid heartbeat, all this would contribute to heart failure, and resulting fluid would collect around the membrane of the heart. And so when the Roman soldier came and thrust that spear in Jesus' heart and side and came out, that was the fluid that had collected. It would be fluid and blood. And of course, John, that's what he described. He, you know, had no idea what he was. He's not a doctor, but we know that's what happens when someone is going through this, where he said it was water and blood. But it was the fluid that's collected from this when you're going through this. And the pierce not broken. Why that's important is that, again, if someone's on the cross and they need their legs to push up debris to speed this along, they would break the legs of the people on there so they could hurry up and just die of asphyxiation. Well, they had broken the thieves that were beside Jesus, but when they got to Jesus, he was already dead. And that's what this sphere was, to check him. And they didn't break his legs. And again, the scripture was fulfilled saying that not one of his bones were broken. And I mentioned that we as the men, when we lead, we have to be careful sometimes from the Lord's table when we're presenting things, when we say Jesus was broken. I know we may understand that we're not saying his body was broken, but it causes some people to cringe when they hear that, because this was he was a perfect sacrifice. No bone was broken. And so we finally got to what we're here to talk about today. So the second part of the resurrection is the hoax or history when we talk about this. And so the things we're going to cover, we're going to look at the burial, we're going to look at the tomb, we're going to look at the empty tomb, the resurrection itself, and we're going to kind of refute some of those things that people have mentioned, some of the things we looked at about myths and conspiracies and hallucinations. So, when Jesus was buried, this is from Matthew 27:57-66. At evening approached, then came a rich man from Arimathea named Joseph, who himself became a disciple of Jesus, going to Pilate. He asked for Jesus' body, and Pilate ordered that it be given to him. Joseph took the body, wrapped it in a clean linen, and placed it in its in his own new tomb that he had cut out from the rock. He rolled a big stone in front of the entrance to the tomb and went away. Mary Magdalene and the other Mary were sitting there opposite the tomb the next day. The next day, the one after preparation day, the chief priests and the Pharisees went to Pilate. "Sir," they said, "we remember that while he was still alive, the deceiver said, 'After 3 days, I will rise again.' So give the order for the tomb to be secured until the third day. Otherwise, his disciples may come, steal the body, tell the people that he's been risen from the dead. This last deception will be worse than the first." "Take a guard," Pilate said. Pilate answered. "Go make the tomb as secure as you know it." So they went out and made the tomb secure by putting a seal on it, on the stone, and posting a guard. So I've got a couple of questions just from this scripture here. So I need some. So what was the Pharisees' concerns?
That they were going to steal his body.
Yeah. He said, yep, because I remember what he said. You know, they'll get in there and steal his body and then basically tell everybody that, you know, because he spoke that he had risen again. So we don't want this. So we want to stop this. So what measures was put in place?
Well, on that first note,
yeah,
if the Pharisees were concerned about them stealing the body, that means that they had the understanding that he was dead. So doesn't that throw out the first four arguments against Jesus not really dying? Or actually, yeah. The last argument.
That's good. That's good. Yeah.
And so they placed the guard and they placed the seal. And it says, make this tomb secure as you know how.
Yeah.
So it had the Roman authorities' signature of approval to post a guard and keep it as secure as possible.
And how long were they going to do that?
At least until the third day.
Yeah, the third day. So around the clock, got these guys here guarding this tomb. So about this. Go ahead.
I was going to say it's funny how this it all worked out, right? I mean, they were trying to prevent something, you know, some kind of a message to be spread by doing all these things. But what it ended up doing is bolstered the evidence of the resurrection, right?
Yep. You're at question four. So let me
sorry.
No, you're good. You're good. But this is good. This is the whole point. So And I thought about this when I was working on this. Do you think the soldiers checked the tomb before securing it?
Yes.
Yeah. I never thought about that. You know, if I'm in charge of, and then we're going to look at another screen. If I'm in charge of something, I'm going to make sure the things in it that I'm supposed to be watching. Because if something happens, and you didn't even know if something was in there or not. So I'm sure the soldiers checked the tomb.
Well, James, it doesn't tell us what happened to the soldiers, but I'm sure it didn't go well for them that the body wasn't there, right?
Right. Yeah. And Parker kind of mentioned, how does this help Jesus' case? This is excellent. They built all of this stuff. They've got someone guarding it for 3 days. They have a Roman seal on it, and we're going to talk about the guard and some other things. So this is beautiful that they've set up for the resurrection. So the precautions at the tomb. Got the stone, we got the Roman seal, and we got the guard. And there we go. Woo! Press the wrong thing. So the stone, the Bible says a large stone was rolled in front of the tomb. The stone was not only sealed the tomb, and it would made it difficult. We'll talk about this in the next one about the stone in front of the tomb. For someone to come right in. All right, I think that's where I was. I was talking about it's a stone, not like a, you know, screen door that somebody could just sneak in. That's something very easy to make. Sealing the tomb that with the skin. And so the Roman seal, it says my internet is unstable. So that's what's going on. I don't know what's going on. I paid my bill. The Roman seal was a sign of authentication that the tomb was occupied and that the power of the authority of Rome stood behind the seal. I wonder, is that kind of like what police do today when they take the tape and they put it over a crime scene or something that you're not supposed to enter, and if you do, the law, you know, in trouble law. I wonder if something like that. I don't know if they use wax or whatever it is, but it was sealed. And of course, anybody found breaking the seal would be, it would be very unpunished. But the thing about the guards here, something I didn't know. Now, I knew the guards, the rule is any prisoner that's in your care gets away, any of those things, you're going to die. That's what it says. And, but one of the things I see here is if a guard fell asleep, so first of all, they weren't allowed to sleep. Guard members, they could not sit down or lean against anything while they're on duty. If a guard member fell asleep, he was beaten and burned with his own clothes. But he was not the only one executed. The entire 16-man guard unit was executed if only one of the members fell asleep while on duty. So this is a big deal. So these guys are serious about, hey, I'm watching something. I'm making sure nothing comes in there and takes it, because my life is on the line if we allow anything like this. So at least for the religious leaders, they felt secure. This was great. Got the Romans taking care of these things. The precautions made by the religious ruler, they felt secure. They're excited about this thing about Jesus is going to go away. We'll be top dogs again. Because, again, it was some jealousy. A lot of things that they were doing was they were jealous of Jesus. And his frightened disciples were scattered, gone into hiding, so they thought they had won. So the actual tomb, if you ever read or seen the story, you usually see a picture like this, what kind of a roof that went along the side that you can't see if you had a top view of it. And you would roll that in that groove kind of downhill slightly and right over the hole. And so it was heavy, so you needed, you know, several people to push it back up the hill and probably put a rock underneath it so it won't roll back down. One of the things in looking at the tomb things, they said that, well, some people don't believe it was actually a round disc. They think it was this, like, corkscrew thing that you see here. And some archaeologists went out and they said, hey, we found a bunch of burial caves, and the majority of them look like this. Only a handful look like the with the disc, and it was usually reserved for very wealthy people. And so what I have here highlighted in yellow was the tomb of Jesus occupied. Was it among the top four Jerusalem tombs? Because that's what they say. You'd have to be like high ranking to get a tomb with a disc in front of it. And they believe that since it was actually borrowed, an unused tomb of Joseph of Arimathea, that it was most likely it wasn't a disc shape blocking the stone. What is one of the things we know about Joseph of Arimathea? As far as his pedigree, or was he just a poor man, a regular everyday man? I meant to stop that when we went. If you guys remember, he was a rich man. Remember, we said at Jesus' death, he was at a rich man. He was in a rich man's tomb. So they're actually collaborating what we're saying. They said only the disc was reserved for very rich people, and it was Joseph of Arimathea, his family, and he himself was rich, and so that would have shown it. But again, others have looked at this in Mark 3. They said the word "roll," the Greek word, said that's actually what they're doing. So you can't mistake this as if you that corkscrew thing, you don't roll it. You actually push it or shove it or something like that. So the idea of roll, they say you can't confuse those two. So they believe it was one of the tombs that actually rolled the large stone across the mound. So the empty tomb here. So after the Sabbath day, the first day of the week, Mary Magdalene and the other Mary went and looked at the tomb. There was a violent earthquake, for an angel of the Lord came down from heaven and, going to the tomb, rolled back the stone and sat on it. His appearance was like lightning, and his clothes were white as snow. The guard the guards were so afraid of him that they shook and became like dead men. The angel said to the women, "Do not be afraid, for I know that you are looking for Jesus, who was crucified. He is not here. He is risen, just as he said. Come and see the place where he lay. Then go quickly and tell his disciples, he has risen from the dead, and he is going ahead of you into Galilee. Then you will see him. Now I have told you." So the women hurried away from the tomb, afraid, yet filled with joy, and ran to tell his disciples. Suddenly Jesus met them. "Greetings," he said. They came to him, clasped his feet, and worshiped him. Then Jesus said to them, "Do not be afraid. Go and tell my brothers to go to Galilee. There I will see them." While the women were on their way, some of the guards went into the city and reported to the chief priests everything that had happened. When the chief priests had met with the elders, they devised a plan. They gave the soldiers a large sum of money, telling them, You are to say, his disciples came during the night and stole him away while you were asleep. If this report gets to the governor, we will satisfy him and keep you out of trouble. So the soldiers took the money and did as they were instructed. And this story has been widely circulated among the Jews to this very day. So we've been talking about looking at evidence, doing the whole class, looking for things. So what kind of evidence do you guys see just in Jesus that he was resurrected, that Mary, the both Marys actually saw something? What are some things that we see that would indicate a resurrection? Take you off mute if you're...
The guards were afraid, so they knew something bad happened. They knew they didn't do their job. Mm-hmm. So either the body was stolen, which it doesn't seem like it had been possible for a few fishermen to get past the whole Roman guard squadron, whatever you want to call it. So they were afraid and became like dead men, likely because they knew that it just wasn't possible and that he was truly resurrected.
I wonder, did the guards actually see the angel? I wonder, is that one of the things that that frightened them, that they it may have been a combination of both of those things there. Do you see what the angel tells Mary? Go look. Go look. He's not here, but I want you to go look. Go look. So they went there. One of the things people say that they went to the wrong tomb. So that's what happened. And Mary and the others, in their grief-stricken, they went to the wrong tomb. And so that's why they went to a tomb where there wasn't anybody, and then they believed that it was actually a resurrection. But you can see the things, the interaction between both Marys, and we're going to talk about hallucinations. Can this both happen here? Two people at the same time, looking at the same vision at the same time. They see Jesus, they worship him. Now, these are women, you know, so we're going to talk, they talk about, if you're going to tell a story, if you're going to make something up, you try to put the best light on the individuals to make them look good. So what's wrong with the women being the first one to actually, what's the problem? Or is there a problem with it?
Could you repeat that question? You're going in and out, right?
I'm sorry. I said, women were the first ones to record or to report that Jesus was resurrected, wasn't in the tomb. And I said, if you're going to make up a story, for this time, would there be anything wrong with saying women are kind of the heroes right now, because the men are behind doors kind of scared and everything? If you were making this up, would you put women as the kind of the brave ones that actually went out to the tomb and do this thing? Would you have that in your narrative to share with everyone that women went out first.
Well, if I remember correctly, women weren't even allowed to testify in court at this time in history. And in this society, we're seen as unreliable sources. So, of course, you wouldn't want women to be your quote-unquote heroes if that was the way you were trying to get your story across.
I'm sorry for the bad connection. So there's a there's an old rabbinical saying that let the words of the law be burned rather than delivered to women. And blessed is he whose children are male, and woe to him whose children are female. And you're right. As far as the law, women couldn't even testify in there. So if you're going to create a legend, you're not going to have the women as kind of the chief people in the story if you want people to believe it, unless it's true. And that's the thing. If it's true, that just happens. That's what happened. That's one of the things. But again, if you're trying to make up a story and you want people to accept it, you're not going to put something out there that generally your culture will reject, because women, right, as far as the story, seems to be the heroes. The men are, like I said, hiding behind their doors, and it just doesn't, it's not a good look. You would rather have some of the men kind of, Peter and John were there at the tomb there, beat up the guards and took the body, you know, something like that. But no, they had women as the first one. So again, if you're trying to get people to believe something, you're not going to put something in there like that. So 1 Corinthians 15, 3 through 8 is a very interesting, just a piece of scripture, because Paul wrote it, but it's the information it contains in it. It's one of the early, it's one of the creeds that people used to put together. A saying about something, and it was something easy that could be recited and remembered. And as you, I'm sure you guys have read plenty of times, for I delivered to you first of all, in which I received, that Christ died for our sins according to the scriptures, that he was buried, that he rose again the third day according to the scriptures, that he was seen by Cephas, then by the 12. After then, he was seen by over 500 brethren at once, of whom the greater part remain to this present, but some have fallen asleep. After that, he was seen by James, then all the apostles. Then last of all, he was seen to me also as one born out of due time. And the reason why 1 Corinthians 15, 3 through that is so important to the narrative of the resurrection, and not, and that's something that legends could have taken place, is because historians and others that have looked at this said the earliest recorded of this creed here, some people are putting it like at 35 CE. If Jesus was crucified in 33 or 30, I forgot what the numbers they could, some people moving around. You're now getting within 2 to 5 years of the crucifixion, of the resurrection, and you have the earliest record actually recording, very easy for someone to remember, someone to recite, about, according to the scriptures, Jesus was killed, he was buried, he was afterwards. Oh, just saying my internet is connection is unstable. I don't know what's going on. But again, these scholars have said, and I thought Parker would find this one particularly interesting. So Robert Funk, a non-Christian scholar, founder of the Jesus Seminars, the conviction that Jesus had risen from the dead had already taken root by the time Paul was converted about 33 CE. On the assumption that Jesus died about 30 CE, the time for development was thus 2 or 3 years at the most. So here's this skeptic saying that even this information here, that this is very early. I mean, you're talking, again, 2 to 3, 5 years. This is very early, and not enough time for legend. And people have already believed that Jesus died according to the scriptures, was raised according to the scriptures. So it wasn't something that developed a long time ago. This was very early after the resurrection. And again, these other men say it too. I'm going to speed up here because I know I've burned out some time. So one of the things, I think this was in our books, there was talking about just looking at this scripture, 1 Corinthians 15:3-8. When Paul says he received this from the apostles when he was converted around 35 AD, and he's according to the scriptures, contains a creedal nature of this tradition. They said this is likely used by early Christians as a statement of faith. Something again, before written, easy to remember, easy to recite. He had this in his notes. I didn't have time to go back and really dig around and check this out. But I don't know. Has anyone ever noticed that when Paul talks about Peter, he never calls him Peter. He calls him Cephas. And I thought that was curious. Like, why would he do that? Why would he only refer to him as Cephas? So the only thing I'm thinking about is when Jerusalem. And Peter talks about the name change, the name he was given. And Paul talks about his new name. It used to be Saul. And he only refers to him, the three times he's mentioned later on, he only calls him Cephas. He never calls him Peter. I thought that was odd. I don't know what that's what he meant by this, but I didn't know that before then. I don't know. Maybe you guys know a reason why he would use that. As opposed to calling him Peter, but something just seems odd that he uses that term. 500 brethren at one time, and of course, his brother was a skeptic, and now we know James was part of the one of the elders at the at least, no, he was a disciple in Jerusalem. And Paul saw him after the ascension. So this is after, we're going to talk about Paul a little bit later, about his, how he fits in all of this. So here's possible explanation. Let me see what time. I'm way past the time. I burned up everything. So if you guys have something to do, I'm going to try to go through this real fast. I'm sorry about this computer thing. I'll send you guys the slides, and you guys can go through it at your own pace. But possible explanations of the appearances of the resurrection, the legends we kind of talked about, and we said, hey, most legends need some time, and this just didn't have enough time. You know, not even 20 years. Within 5 years, you know, this letter, 1 Corinthians 15, so there's just not enough time for a legend to be developed. Hallucinations. You might be getting an individual encounter, but when you have two people or 500 people, and last time I checked, I don't think hallucinations last for 40 days. If they do, you really have some, there's some mental problem. And would they last 40 days for like a lot of people, like all the 11 apostles and others? Would it last that long? So a hallucination is a big jump. A hallucination, don't talk back. All of these things that were being recorded is not typical of what people call hallucinations. And as far as appearances, this is before we even get to the book of Acts, that the other people that saw Jesus before his ascension. So Mary, the other women, Peter saw him, those that was on the road to Emmaus, the 11 disciples, Thomas. One time he was absent, then Thomas was there the second time, and Jesus said, hey, took hands, feet, side, all these things here. So not really, it wasn't just one person thing. A lot of people saw the resurrected Christ. Wishful thinking. They talk about wishful thinking, that the people, they wanted this so bad, that Jesus to be back alive and those things like that. And but you think about the encounters with angels, thought with gardeners, traveling on the road to Emmaus, and, you know, he's really Christ himself. It was, I mean, those guys to Emmaus, they thought Jesus, they said, man, we hoped he was the one. We were really hoping. So they thought that this was done. Wishful thinking. Yeah, but they were past that until you know, Jesus revealed himself to those guys. Wishful thinking might explain initial hopefulness, but as you getting down to these other things, that really doesn't explain. That's not a good explanation as far as I've got two more. I think I have one. Yeah. So this one, he says something else. The disciples saw something, but they sincerely believe that what they saw was the risen Christ, but it was not. That's impossible. It was something else. He said he just something else. He said he just included this as an explanation because he had actually heard it used by someone who otherwise normally rational and intelligent. It is an example of the simple rejection of the resurrection on philosophical grounds. And remember, I think one of our first class, we said, it often boils down to, it's not about facts, it's not about evidence, it's really about the will and the heart. Here it is, and I just refuse it. I don't want it. I don't want it, what it's going to mean for my life. So it's not for a lack of information. It's just that I don't want it. And I got this thing. So the other things that needs to be explained, somebody has to explain the Apostle Paul of conversion. Somebody has to explain that. Why did this guy that was killing people against it, why did he give up all of that, the fame and the fortune and the prestige, to be hunted and live like the scourge of the earth as a Christian? Why would he do that? Somebody just produce a body, anybody. I'm surprised nobody didn't even find some other body. No one even produced a body for this. And we've said this over, men don't die for something they know is not true. There's a lot more stuff in here. I am sorry I've taken you long. I'm sorry for the internet. Next time I'm going to make sure I just use my phone hotspot. I know this is an old computer, but I'm sorry that it broke the class and everything. And forgive me if it just, you know, it was hard to follow with all the disruption. So we'll try class 12 on Sunday. And then we'll have a review. And again, if there's some other stuff you guys want us to look at, some other questions you have that we as a group can look at them as we try to plan our review for Wednesday. But I appreciate you guys' patience with me. And again, I'm sorry for all the internet craziness. Good to see everybody.
Thanks, James.
Thanks, James.
Yep. Thank you.
Yeah. Wait.
All right, guys.
Take care.